Here's a third example. I live in Dallas, and downtown there's this really great museum that has an exhibit that I feel an attachment to. It is a long scroll, a decades-old printout from a UPI wire machine at a radio station in Illinois. It starts out as sort of a regular stream of copy. You know, there's a weather report. You know, there's, you know, rainfall exceeded an inch expected. And then there's the start of a crime story. You know, Edwardsville, Illinois, the Madison County Sheriff's Office said today it has no clues. And then all of a sudden it stops. And then "get off" appears on the transcript. And there's two more the same. "Get off, get off" with wire codes as they used in that era. And then comes this. Bulletin: an unknown sniper fired 3 shots at PTOU. Now, this guy, you know, POTUS, President of the United States, is what he should have typed. But, you know, he was freaking out a little bit. So he got PTOU out. Then we get Kennedy misspelled. And then we get, again, Kennedy seriously wounded. And then another order from the wire operator: stay off, all of you. Stay off and keep off. Get off. Back in those days, if too many people were transmitting wire copy at the same time, you know, the system would not be able to take it and would break down. And then somebody wasn't paying attention, apparently, because somebody else starts to transmit a story speaking at the, and then immediately, "will you please stay off this wire till we give," and then it kind of trails off, "stay off, stay off." And we get a more detailed lead, but again, a sniper seriously wounded, something that should be President Kennedy, downtown Dallas today, perhaps fatally. It's interesting, if you look at that letter, that set of letters there, most of them are one key off from what they should have been. So you could see that, you know, the typing was just going a little too fast. And then finally you get something solid. President Kennedy and Governor John Connally of Texas have been cut down by assassin's bullets in downtown Dallas. They were riding in an open automobile when the shots were fired. The president, his limp body cradled in the arms of his wife, Jacqueline, has been rushed to Parkland Hospital. And one final stay off in the corner. Now, when you look at this, there are two things that jump out at me. One, it's interesting how the phrase "cut down by assassin's bullets" implies that both of them are dead, when of course they're not. Connally survived. And the second thing is the phrase "his limp body cradled in the arms of his wife." The guy who's writing this clearly realizes this is the most important story he's ever going to write in his life. And he is trying to add a little note of poetry to what he is writing. But for me, and I think probably for most people who work in news organizations at the very least, and other people too, there was plenty of poetry long before this. You know, this is a very affecting stream of information for people, because you can immediately, just from this raw information, imagine what was going on in that newsroom and how everybody was going nuts and how everything was going at double speed and triple speed and how, you know, the insanity of that moment. This printout is in the Sixth Floor Museum, which is in the former Texas School Book Depository building in Dealey Plaza. And the positioning within the museum is right after you turn a corner. You know, there's a path you follow in the museum, and right after you turn a corner and right when you approach the window that Oswald was at, there's this. And, you know, I've been in this museum a dozen times because there aren't that many other things to take out-of-town visitors to in Dallas. And, you know, I get choked up every time I walk past it. You know, I was not alive when Kennedy was shot. You know, it doesn't have that sort of visceral connection to me hearing about it, but seeing it through this sort of raw form, you know, connects emotionally in a way that, you know, again, you don't need a long form narrative to do that. You can do that in a sort of raw flow of copy. There's another thing I didn't include in here. Who here has heard of the website Metafilter? It's sort of a collective blog. It's a wonderful site where people post things. It's better than it sounds. But if you're ever interested, go back to September 11th, 2001 in their archives, and you see the post that someone put up saying, "gee, I just saw something about someone's plane entering, you know, hitting the World Trade Center." And then this long stream of comments of people, you know, gathering information, people overseas saying, "well, Sky News in Australia is telling us this," or, you know, that this, you know, people, you know, all the panic and things that you associate with that day. And this stream of comments completely evokes that moment in a way that, you know, many book-length treatments would not. All right, proposition 3, the last two propositions are shorter. Blogs can shift you from the news peg model to the moment model. Now, of course, again, speaking of narrative, getting out of the newspeg model is one of the wonderful things about narrative journalism. It's great for telling stories that don't have a nut graph, stories about people who would normally get ignored by the media. You know, you couldn't write a story about Enrique in traditional newspaper style, you know, a Honduran boy successfully reached America by train several months ago, according to those familiar with the situation. That just would not work. But blogs can do the same thing. You know, in a way, sports writers have it easy because there's the convention in sports writing that at the end of, you know, your daily story about the Patriots or the Cowboys or whatever beat you're covering, you have the notes section at the end, which is like, and here are four other interesting things that happened today. And it's a lovely place to take these things that don't quite meet the bar of being story-worthy, but are still interesting. Remember the question, is it a story and is it interesting are two different questions. The things that don't make the article cut don't all miss it for the same reason. Some of them are perfectly interesting, but kind of inconsequential. You know, there's a stray observation, a little slice of life, just one single moment. Others aren't inconsequential, but they might advance a previous story only a little bit, so you can't justify writing another story about it, but it's still interesting to people who are interested in the topic that you're writing about, but even if it's not enough to justify a headline in the paper. Over time, those little posts can really add up to huge stories that would not have seen the light of day otherwise. I presume a lot of you, hopefully a lot of you, have heard of talkingpointsmemo.com, which is a wonderful political blog run by the very talented Josh Marshall, this guy here. A lot of Josh's in this talk. It's a politics blog, and it has a left of center point of view. But he's a journalist. He's a real journalist. He's not an ideologue. And I don't think it's too much to say that the entire U.S. attorney's scandal that ended up ousting Alberto Gonzalez from the attorney general's slot would not have come to light if it weren't for Talking Points Memo. You know, Marsh, he just won a Polk Award a couple weeks ago for that coverage, which is kind of a new thing for a blog. And part of the reason that Talking Points was able to do that was precisely because they are a blog. If they were a newspaper, they would not have been able to break the story in the same way. And if you think back, there was an unusual round of firings around the country of these U.S. attorneys, but they were dispersed enough and quiet enough that no one was able to put the pieces together. There was no, you know, local newspaper in Arizona or wherever someone got fired wouldn't know enough to be able to put everything together and say, well, this is a pattern. But once Josh started noticing that a few of these things were going on, he turned to his audience and say, what are you guys hearing about this? He would post stuff on his blog saying, if you see anything about something weird about your local U.S. attorney's office, you know, write in. This is kind of weird. And you know, the clues started to come in. You know, they were small on their own often, but over time they were able to be assembled into something larger that wouldn't have happened, you know, didn't happen at any newspaper. I mean, there were plenty of reporters covering the Justice Department and nobody else got this. You know, tipsters within the U.S. Attorney's office would would get a link, you know, saying, someone say, look at what this guy's doing, and they'd start, you know, leaking from the inside. You know, the critical difference is that it's unlikely any newspaper would have ever put together enough pieces of the story to publish something without first publicizing the smaller pieces that they already had. You know, if it's the New York Times and you're gonna wait and, you know, you wanna put this on page one, you've gotta get a very solid story before you can put it on page one. And you're not gonna get that solid story unless you can put together this pattern. Whereas what Josh Marshall did was basically taking little bits and saying, this is weird. Throwing it out to the world and saying, doing these little micro updates, taking it out of the story model and the nut graph model and transferring it to something new. In this story, one of the things that Marshall told the New York Times, we have kind of broken free of the model of discrete articles that have a beginning and end. Instead, there are an ongoing series of dispatches. And again, this goes back to reporting in its natural state. This is taking away the silly conventions that we've established in our industry over time and getting back to something that is raw and real. Proposition four, final one, blogs can create characters out of sources or out of reporters. You could see a bit of this in the previous examples. You know, think about how someone who has read one of those Apple blogs sees Steve Jobs. They can see how he talks, they see his mannerisms, they see him as a rounded character. Where someone who read a Wire story about Apple's announcement sees him as a guy who got quoted, and you know, a rich guy who apparently has a lot of cool toys. for the coup attempt in the legislature, if you read my paper's front page story, you saw all the names of all the people involved. But if you read the blog, you saw all the characters in the drama. And you saw who was aligned with whom, who got dissed, how they got dissed, who was sweating the most, who was freezing up under pressure. And this is particularly true over time as a blog covers the same people over and over again. Patterns start to be established, and you know, your readers get to see who the spokesperson for the mayor really is. And you get to see how he works. And you get to share that level of detail with your readers in a way that doesn't have to be forced into story form. But the transformation can work in the other direction too. When reporters blog, readers start to think of them as human beings instead of these faceless automatons who work for news organizations. Or they probably don't even think of them as people who work for news organizations. You know, I have an opinion, a long-held opinion, that making reporters more human is very key to the future of our industry. And this, that involves, you know, the voice issues that we're talking about. It involves, you know, creating a conversation with readers. And it involves the sort of development of reporters into character. A few years ago, I'd been basically a straight news education reporter at the Dallas Morning News for a few years at this point, about 4 years ago. And my editors came to me and said, we would like you to write a column once a month and, you know, throw some opinion in there. And I completely freaked out. You know, I had what would Scotty Reston do? And, you know, I had this idea that, you know, we must not, well, Scotty Reston's not a very good example, actually, but, you know, this was a horrible idea. This would open up all this can of worms. You know, people would be saying all these horrible things about me. But it didn't happen. I started writing these columns, and I would get 20 times more response to my most boring column than I would to my most interesting news story. I would get people who would email me tips and story ideas who never would have done that if they just saw me as a byline instead of seeing me as a mug and a guy who has opinions and who uses the word I every so often. And not once in 4 years has anyone criticized the ethics of one of my news stories by saying, you wrote something in a column. I expected it to happen all the time. It has not happened once. Last thing I'll say, in 2003, I had a fellowship to do some reporting in Zambia. And I was doing some stories about AIDS, you know, what else do you do in Zambia? But I knew that the experience was going to be a lot richer than, you know, just interviewing people about AIDS. So I decided on a whim to register ZambiaStories.com. And I decided I was just going to blog about what I saw. And I wrote about stupid stuff. I wrote about drunk German middle-aged men hitting on the young Scandinavian girls at my hostel that I was staying at in Lusaka. You know, cliff jumping at Victoria Falls, the weird faux Irish pubs in Livingston. You know, how they call traffic lights robots in Africa, which always kind of freaks me out. I was trying to evoke the feelings of adventure and discovery and exploration and excitement that I had while I was doing all this reporting. I eventually came back to the U.S. and I wrote a few stories about AIDS, and they were fine, but they were forgotten as soon as they appeared in the paper. You know, I didn't exactly break any new ground. But I still get emails all the time from people who find this now almost five-year-old blog and engage with it. This is an email I got about a week and a half ago. I stumbled on Zambia stories while Googling images of Zambia. I understand you wrote it back in 2003, but luckily for me, it remains on the net. I just want to say thank you for keeping that blog and putting your writings on. You know, I will use your writings to help tide me over until I can return. I miss my village. I miss Colombo and Lusaka and Durban, Drakensberg and Dar es Salaam. And I miss those robots. Your writings are like food for the heart in a time of waiting. Now, this site is, again, it's not great prose. It's not going to win any awards. But it is going to be remembered in a way that my news stories from Zambia are not at all going to be remembered. Because it has humanity, and it has a way of engaging with the reader that I think a lot of our newspapers could benefit from. And while narrative journalism is a great way to do that, I hope that I've gone some way to convincing you that blogging can also do some of that as well. So, thank you.
We ask people to, if you want to ask a question, please line up at the microphone queue if you're an Anglophile. And while you're doing that, I'm supposed to ask one time-wasting but very important question to sort of let everybody do that sort of thing. I'm sort of wondering if you could say anything about book authors. You know, this is the ultimate in long-form journalism who use a blog sort of as a way to keep their name bubbling, you know, almost as advertising for their endeavors. And do you think that that's useful, or how do you see that?
Well, I think it is certainly useful, and just as this is separate from my topic, really, but certainly everyone here in the room, if you have not already, go buy your domain name, you know, yourname.com, because, you know, someone is going to define your presence on the internet, and you'd rather it be you, and you should have that, and you should start a blog on it, in part because it is really good practice. You know, I've been doing crab walk for 7 years, and my writing has improved so much more through writing crab walk than it has by writing lots of daily stories for the Dallas Morning News. You know, it is a wonderful case way of learning to write and improve. In the case of book authors, absolutely. You know, I did a few years ago, a friend of mine is in book marketing, and he started the first virtual book tour, where instead of going from city to city and bookstore to bookstore, authors go from blog to blog and do interviews with blog authors and things. And I did the first one. And absolutely, for book authors, it is the best venue for promotion that there is, in my opinion, because it is low cost, and it also allows you to target people who are really actually interested in your book in a way that going to your local borders really, really doesn't.
Please go ahead. Please ask.
Hi. I'm curious to hear more about your role as both a reporter and a blogger. I'll be perfectly honest, I was a newspaper reporter for many years, and I'm now moving into blogging, and also I'm the editor of a small magazine in Vermont. And I really want to put my opinions on my blog, but I am worried about how my magazine would be perceived, and also if I wanted to in the future as a freelancer get any story assignments on the subjects that I'm opinionating about.
Right.
You know, would you suggest that I follow your advice of not editorializing but just simply observing, and how do you know when you've crossed that line?
It's a tough question. I initially, when they wanted me to start this column, they said, well, we don't want you to have opinions, but you should have perspectives. And I said, could you please list the difference between opinions and perspectives? They could not, which is funny because actually for the last 2 years, I've won the best opinion writer competition in the Big Education Writers Competition nationally, and I have to go up and say, I'm not an opinion writer. I don't have opinions. Shut up. Don't give me this. But I said, initially, when I started Crab Walk, I was completely freaked out about all these issues you're talking about. And I did it anonymously. I didn't want anyone to know who I was, which, you know, Google figures that out really fast. Because you could never mention your name, and still it will be the first result, you know, searching for your name in Google because of their algorithms. I think that over time, I've become a lot more calm about it. I set the following rules for my personal blog for Crab Walk. I never write about work in any negative way. Something good happened, I'll write about it, but I don't write about anything negative about work. And I write about education policy professionally, so I don't write anything about education. But beyond that, there's a whole wide world of things to write about. For my column, which is also the same issue of opinion impinging on your normal reporting, I set rules that I try not to do anything that is on the news that I might be writing about sometime soon in a news capacity. And, you know, as Dan mentioned, I've, for the last 4 years, have been doing all these investigative series on detecting cheating on the state test in Texas. And I have never written a column about that because that's just too close. So you do have to set boundaries. I will share one just to scare all of you to death. I will share one really horrible story. A very good friend of mine was applying for a job at AP, being an immigration reporter. And she went and applied for the job. They loved her. They offered her the job. And while she was flying back to her home after the job was offered, they Googled her. And they found that she had, turns out that her mother is a lesbian, and she had written in college an opinion piece talking about how she didn't like the Republicans' point of view on gay issues, a very sort of angry piece. Nothing to do with immigration or anything like that. But when she landed, she had a voicemail from AP saying, we have to retract the job offer because you have an expressed opinion about one of the two parties we have. That was a few years ago. I don't know if that would happen today. And I also don't know how applicable AP is to the rest of the world. I would think that a whole lot of people would have different standards than the standards AP sets. But yeah, you do have to be careful, you know. On the other hand, you know, I don't know how big your magazine is or anything like that, but, you know, the country publisher tradition in America of, you know, the guy who writes the editorials but is also in charge, that's a long-standing tradition that has served many people well. So be cautious, but also be bold. How's that?
Thanks.
Hi. I don't write a blog, but a couple of the stories that
you
I've,
will, don't worry.
A couple of stories that I've written have gotten picked up by blogs.
Right.
And I like that, and so do the people I like who I write about, because I write about science and medicine, so it's a good way to get a story beyond a limited publication.
Sure.
And so I was hoping to hear some tips on how to get noticed by blogs.
The easiest way, way number one, be awesome. That always helps. I'm sure you're already accomplishing that. In my experience, you know, I get pitched. It's funny because no one reads my damn blog. You know, it used to be popular, but it's gone fallow. As long as someone is doing the pitch in an intelligent way, like if you go to some random gadget site and you pitch them something about, you know, nuclear physics, they're not going to be interested, and they're going to ban you and, you know, send all your emails to the junk folder from here on out. If you target the people that you're emailing to, or you just say, hey, you write a lot about this, I wrote this great story about it, here you go. A fair amount of time, you know, bloggers need content, particularly blogs that are professional in nature, where they have like quotas of the certain number of posts that they have to do per day. There are a growing number of these. I found that blogs are willing to do that and be pitched in a way not dissimilar to that. The other thing, that the broader advice, this is not new advice, but you know, leave lots of comments on blogs that are somewhat similar. You know, intelligent comments, you know, don't just leave comments for comments' sake. But if you're adding to the conversation and, you know, and there's a URL attached to your name, people will click on it. And it's much more like, you know, and also if you link to other people's articles, part of the magic of the internet is that if you link to my blog, I can tell. I can see if people are clicking a link on your blog to go to my blog. And, you know, we all like to find out who's linking to us. So I'll go read your blog. And that will make it more likely to sort of create the ecosystem that can, you know, lead to your future startup.
Joshua, thank you. This has been really great. I've spent the last 20 years in traditional newsrooms and in a print person, and I just started blogging. I've done 4 entries so far.
All right.
And you know, I always had this wonderful safety net, which is stories that I would do would be lawyered, the big stories, the long pieces. The book I just wrote underwent 8-week legal vetting before it was published. Mm. And, you know, I got to say, I'm nervous about this blogging thing. You hit the publish button, it's out there.
Yeah.
How did you have the same experience?
But the great thing about it is that you can unpublish. But
or change things, yeah.
Yes. There is a section of the U.S. Code, I think it's called Section 280. I could be wrong about the exact site, so if you Google Section 280, nothing comes up. I'm sorry. It is basically the cover your ass section of the code, which the main purpose of it is saying that if you have a blog and someone leaves a libelous comment on your blog, then it's not your fault. As long, you know, that you're not legally liable for that. And there are a number of, you know, in the same way that if newspapers publish correction and there is no actual malice after something is shown to be wrong, and there is no actual malice and all the other libel guidelines, you know, you're fine. Now, I don't know the kind of things that you're writing. If you're, you know, you run the potential child molester blog and you're trying to say, well, this guy looks like a pedophile, then I retract everything I've said. You should just not blog. But and for the most part, the legal standards are a lot better than you think they might be. This is, you know, the same be cautious but be bold. I'll emphasize the bold on this one. You know, it would be a rare, I don't know of many circumstances where bloggers have actually gotten into legal trouble for that. Because all you have to, you know, if in the worst case scenario, you write a big honking apology on top of your page saying, I am really sorry, that was completely wrong, I take it back, please don't sue me, and you're generally going to be fine.
Thus far, I've written very gentle things, so thank you.
Hi. I also recently started a blog, and it has to do with end-of-life experiences. I'm not connected to a newsroom. And I'm curious.
Newsrooms would be a great place for end-of-life experiences, but yes, sorry.
I'm curious about, it's really almost how people read blogs. When I write a piece, should I consider it as a self-contained post? Or how much should one post connect to the previous post?
I think there is not a one stylistic guideline to say you do it this way or you do it a different way. In my experience, traditional journalists who move into blogging, if they have there are lots of advantages. Obviously, you know how to write a lot better than most people who blog, and you sort of understand storytelling in a way that most people don't. But a lot of people make that transition write way too long, and they write in a way too self-contained of a way. They view it as, this is my article for today, and then the next day, this is my article for tomorrow. And I think that's fine. No one's gonna like ban you from blogging if you do that, but I think you can take advantage of the form. I mean, one of the great things about writing a blog is that it can be interconnected. It can be interconnected with other people's websites, but it could also be interconnected within your website. And there are many times, if you go look through the archives of crabwalk.com, you'll see many times where I'll say, remember that post I wrote 6 months ago about so-and-so? Well, this other cool thing happened about that same thing. And it sort of, you know, creates a sort of holistic nature to the blog. You know, there are certain themes that I keep coming back to, you know, on a regular basis, and, you know, tropes that you like to repeat. But, you know, you do it with sort of a feeling of adventure and just try it out. The great thing about a blog is that you don't have a structure that is imposed on you. And just try it out. See what works.
Thank you.
Sure.
I'm a journalist who's been doing this for 30 years, and I'm afraid to blog. But some of the people on our paper are doing it. Our political reporters recently went out to cover the presidential primaries, Super Tuesday, and they blogged about what they were doing. If you don't blog about your education policy, is it wrong for us to send our political reporters out to cover things and blog?
No, not at all. Part of my reason for, remember, I'm talking about my personal blog. It has nothing to do with the newspaper.
Okay.
I did for a while until I came to Harvard for a year on a fellowship and forgot everything I'd ever done before. I did blog for the Dallas Morning News for a while as part of a group blog that, quite frankly, wasn't all that great. Isn't all that great, still there. But I would go into some education things there because that was my job. You know, you don't have as much freedom to opine. You know, if I'm writing, I don't cover City Hall. I'm never going to cover City Hall in Dallas. If there's something stupid that goes on City Hall, I have a little bit more room to talk about that on a work blog because it's not my beat than the City Hall reporter certainly does. But as certainly, I imagine, if the political reporters are anything like a lot of other political reporters who blog Super Tuesday and things of that sort, they're probably not saying, man, I love Obama. That's probably not what they're typing. They're probably doing the scene stuff. They're probably saying, man, there are a whole lot of Obama people at this polling station, or, man, I've been talking to a lot of people, and there's all this buzz about some leaked early polling exit poll data. And they're probably doing reporting, just a more open, expansive definition of reporting, and that's certainly fine. You know, in politics, though, certainly you have much stricter rules about opining as long as you're with a mainstream news organization.
Does anyone ever look at your blog before you put it out there, an editor look at it, or?
No.
Okay.
My work blog, there are lots of debates within news organizations. News organizations are, in my opinion, horrendously conservative about all these ideas. You know, the idea that blog posts all need to be edited before they, you know, some newspapers do that. And they will say that, you know, just like some newspapers will mandate that all comments have to be read by 3 editors before they are posted to a blog. I think that's way too much caution, in my opinion. But my blog is not edited in any way. My personal blog, for several years, you know, no one at the newspaper knew about it until I started seeing in my logs on the website that, you know, DallasMorningNews.com addresses were being used to access, and it wasn't me, and I started to freak out. And then finally, at one point, there was a story about my blog in the New York Times at one point. And as that story came along, I knew it was going to be the Times, so I said, okay, I got to tell my bosses about this. And it's a weird sensation having the publisher on down reading your thoughts on Canadian indie rock and, you know, whatever else you've written about, you know, and hamburgers having food fights, I don't know. But it was fine. And now, you know, all my editors read Crab Walk, and it's perfectly fine.
We have about 10 minutes, so we can probably take these 3 questions if we can, you know, ring Mr. Benton.
Okay. I have a question about context in blogging.
Yes.
I was sitting here trying to sort of juxtapose in my head your marvelous talk and what the Post ladies were saying this morning about their Walter Reed story. And I was struck by...
I wasn't there, so I'm sorry.
Well, they described what was a very familiar feeling to me of going into this world of the military knowing really almost nothing about the context and really having to kind of sit there for a while before they felt like they began to have any clue. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what you do with that as far as blogging, because, you know, as traditional print people, it seems like we're loath to admit when we really don't know anything about something. So I'm curious how you start blogging on a topic you don't know much about, and what you do with your own ignorance in that context.
One of the one other of my hobby horses that I didn't really get into much here is the idea of transparency. You know, I think transparency is going to be a much more important thing going forward in newspapers and everything else. And I think part of that is having a more honest conversation with our readers than we often do now. The way we kind of, you know, bullshit our way into, like, I'm really an authority on this matter that I just, you know, saw a press release about for the first time 20 minutes ago. The great thing about blogging is that you can make that contextualization and that learning process visible. And that can be a scary thing for reporters who are raised on the idea that you are an authority figure. You have to be an authority figure. You're not allowed to show weakness. You know, I feel like we've all been raised by abusive parents in this industry. I think that it's a wonderful thing. You know, some of the smartest people, you know, guys like Josh Marshall and really smart people who run blogs, they are completely open to saying, I have no idea what's going on here. Anybody got any ideas? Like, you could start up, if you're writing a blog about, you know, 19th century Romanian literature and you don't know anything about it, you can start off by saying, anybody can tell me what books I should read? You know, you can have that conversation. And when you have a reaction to something, you can say, am I right on this? Am I getting this right? And people will respond. And when you have that open exchange as you're creating the context that you're talking about, it creates a much more open environment. Now, I'm not going to pretend that this is what you have to do on every story. I don't think that, you know, Dana Priest and, you know, Ann Hull should have been, you know, blogging like, man, I hear there's some crazy stuff going on with Walter Reed. What's this all about? But I think there are a whole lot of circumstances where it really would work. And so there you go.
Thank you.
So I live in Albany, New York.
Could you speak into the microphone a little bit lately.
Yes.
I'm not one to read a lot of our local political, meaning, you know, statewide blogs, but you know, I kind of found myself sort of obsessing over them, just like everybody else did last week, and all the drama that was kind of taking place.
Did something happen last week?
Yeah, I don't know. It was like three blocks from my apartment. The issue becomes, I'm not a huge state political junkie, but I find myself reading it, and it was really fascinating to read the blogs during this, like, big time when all this crazy stuff was happening, but I don't read it the rest of the time when a governor isn't with prostitutes stepping down. So I think the question becomes, how do you make your topic or whatever you're writing about interesting enough that people might want to come back when there's not a 9/11 or a Kennedy assassination or prostitutes or whatever? And the next sort of the follow-up to that would be, what kind of things seem to trigger in your mind, oh, I should blog about this particular item as much as anything else?
On the first one, the vast majority of blogs out there, and by this I don't mean personal blogs, but I mean blogs that have a sort of journalistic sense about themselves, attach themselves to a specific niche. I don't think that the guy who's writing the state politics blog in Albany really expects, you know, people around the world to, you know, be, you know, busy hitting reload, you know, to, you know, get the latest update. He realizes, or whoever's doing it probably realizes, there's an audience for this. I'm going to try and serve that audience. I'm going to be interesting to that audience. And it would probably be fruitless for him to try and say, you know, all the people who read Perez Hilton, I really want them to be reading my blog instead. You know, it's just not going to work. Just like we at the Dallas Morning News are probably not going to write a lot of stories that are interesting to people in Schenectady, you know, because we have our niche. One of the great things that sometimes events like this cause, you know, big Spitzerian moments, is that it allows blogs that have been really good in private, essentially, that have been these great undiscovered blogs, this huge onslaught of hits go to them if they've done one thing that is outstanding. And then everyone starts clicking through the archives and think, man, this guy's really, really funny, or this guy really knows his stuff, or this guy has really interesting, you know, opinions on something. And it will inspire, you know, this attachment from a long-term perspective. You know, I have my Net Newswire open, my RSS reader with my 1,000 RSS feeds or so that I read every day because I, again, am a freak. And a lot of these blogs are, you know, blogs that I saw one thing on interesting some years ago, and I've just become attached. And that's all it takes is one interesting blog. To your second question, I don't know if what inspires me to think this is bloggable. Part of it is, you know, I've been doing this blog for 7 years now, so I kind of know what my shtick is. I know what the themes are that I hit on. They're interesting to some people. They're not at all interesting to others. But for my personal blog, I don't really care how many people read it, so I'm just really doing it to amuse myself. You know, one of the biggest blogs out there is Kotke.org. I mentioned it earlier. Run by this guy, Jason Kotke. He just had his, I think today is his 10-year, yesterday was his 10-year anniversary doing this blog. He was an early guy. And he just says, I post about stuff that I find interesting. You know, some guy left a comment a couple days ago saying, man, no one cares about The Wire. Stop blogging about The Wire. All you do is blog about The Wire. And he wrote back, please leave my website. I don't care what you want. I'm doing this. If you know, I'm creating this product. If you want to partake of the product, fine. Otherwise, there are, I don't know, 10 million other blogs out there that you can choose from. So I think, you know, for me, it's just really, do I find it interesting? You know, as I said, the question is it a story versus is it interesting? For me, it's the latter. And if I think it's interesting, I might put something up. And also, if I haven't posted in a while, then the bar gets a little lower. Like, oh, God, I got to put something up. But
we'll make this the last question.
Hello. Do you think that style matters in blogging? I mean, you use this interesting phrase of natural storytelling. So do you think the more oral the writing is, the better, the raw, the director?
Yeah.
Or do you rewrite also? Do you make first drafts? And or do you just put it into and say the content and the directness is so important that the style is like of secondness importance?
On the issue of drafts, I have a blogging program here, and I have all these stories that I'm interested in posting about that have been incubating for a while. So most of these are not in particularly exciting draft form. You know, a rival Cajun Music Hall of Fame is being formed. You know, so I'm just a reminder to post something about it. The big honking list of blog posts. You know, but so to your question, yes, I do think style matters a lot. It matters a lot in different ways on different blogs. There are, back here, there are some of these blogs in here, you know, let's go to the journalism blogs. Some of these people, you know, journerdism is a guy who writes all sorts of stuff about tech stuff in journalism and interesting new ideas. I don't care about his style at all. He just has really interesting content. A lot of times he'll just have a link and, you know, write a paragraph or write a sentence or not write anything at all. And that's fine. There are other, you know, one of the more popular websites, blogs out there is Deuce.com, D-O-O-C-E. It's this woman who is a mom who lives in Utah. And she writes this blog about being a mom in Utah. And she's a really good writer. And she has created this enormous community of people around her who think that she is just the cat's pajamas. And as a result, her style really matters because the people who go there really want to read her writing, and they want to see, oh, here she's snapping a photo with her iPhone and all the rest. Bourbon, yeah, I'm sure her daughter will love reading the site at some point when she's older. So for some people, the style really matters. Oh, she won a blocky, I guess, which is silly. So I guess the answer is yes, it really matters if it's something that you want to make matter. There are some websites where it's really important and others where it's not. If you want to write something that is going to be read because it is well written, then it really matters if you write it well, I suppose.
All right. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Lunch is in the foyer out there, so.